We're carrying on tonight with our series Getting to Grips with the Bible. In this series we've been picking out some of the key passages from the Old and New Testaments, passages that carry forward the main storyline of the Bible, the central message of the Bible. For your information, after this evening, I expect, God willing, that there'll be just three further studies in the series. So we are moving towards the end of this series. Now, in the last few weeks, we've been looking at a number of the most important passages from Paul's letters. And we read together earlier from the letter to the Ephesians. We read from Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17, through to Ephesians chapter 5, verse 7. And those are the verses I want us to think about tonight. We're thinking tonight about the Christian life and the standards by which Christians must live. We've looked a little in the last few weeks at Paul's theology. In Romans, we looked at his theology of sin and of justification. In Philippians, we looked at his theology of the person of Christ. In the earlier chapters of Ephesians, we looked at his theology concerning God's plan and the relationship between Jew and Gentile. But Paul is always concerned when he has spelled out his theology, when he's shared his doctrinal perspective, he's always concerned to turn it into practice. And that's what we have here then in the verses we've read. We've got the most practical instruction for the Christian life. Now, the passage that we've read divides into two main divisions. Firstly, we're going to be looking at Paul's general counsel, the whole way we approach the Christian life. We'll be looking there at chapter 4, verse 17, through to chapter 4, verse 25. In those verses, Paul deals with our whole approach to the Christian life. And then, in 4:25 onwards, he goes on to apply that to some particular situations and some particular areas of Christian living. So first of all, we are looking at the whole way we approach the Christian life in chapter 4, verse 17 onwards. Now Paul here has three great perspectives to bring. Three vital directions to give, which will affect the whole way we approach our Christian lives. The first of them, in verse 17 onwards, Paul tells us that Christians must aim to be different from the world. That is the first general directive he gives us. Christians must aim to be different from the world. Christians must recognize the world around them to be an enemy, and they must stand in conscious rejection of the world and its thinking and its values. He makes that very explicit, doesn't he, in verse 17. So I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do. He's writing to Gentiles. He's writing to people who live in the Turkish town of Ephesus. And he says, you must be absolutely different from your fellow Gentiles. You must aim to be completely different from the people around you. You used to live as other Gentiles do. You used to share their lifestyle. But now you must make a radical break with them. Your goal must be to be different from them at every point. Now, he's talking here about lifestyle, behavior. You must no longer live as the Gentiles do. But then he goes on to make it clear why the Gentiles' lifestyle is so abhorrent, why the Gentiles behave in such unacceptable ways. He says it is because their thinking is all wrong. You must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. It's not just that you've got to change your behavior. You're going to have to change your thinking, because the way the Gentiles think is futile. This is the first of a series of accusations that Paul makes against the unbelieving world, against the Gentiles. He says their thinking is futile. In other words, their thinking leads nowhere. Unbelievers do think. Don't doubt that. If you walk into any university library, then there is plenty of evidence that unbelievers do think and can think. And you see the row after row after row of books arguing about anything and everything, reasoning in matters of mathematics and matters of psychology and matters of history and matters of literary criticism. Here is all the thinking of the world on those shelves. And if you go to the internet, then you'll find endless websites in which people set forth their arguments and discuss contemporary issues and reason about this and that and the other. And if you turn on your television set, then on every channel you will get discussion shows where people are using their minds and are debating and reasoning and bringing arguments to bear upon all sorts of different issues. Yes, the world is reasoning. It's thinking all the time. But Paul says their thinking is futile. It's pointless. It's because it is all based on false assumptions. It doesn't matter how good a person is at reasoning. It doesn't matter how clear their logic is. It doesn't matter how high their IQ is. If they start with false premises, then they will come to false conclusions. And their thinking, this whole massive reasoning exercise, will be futile. And Paul says that is the way the world is. The Gentiles think in an absolutely futile way. They devote this huge scholarship, they devote this huge energy to thinking about anything and everything, and what they come up with in the end is plain wrong. Because they've started in the wrong place. Every unbeliever thinks in a futile way because he starts at the wrong point. He starts with the assumption that he or she is all important. That is at the root of the way every unbeliever thinks. They say, I'm the center of the universe. The universe exists for me. Nothing matters as much as my happiness, my fulfillment, my satisfaction. I must be free to seek what is best for myself. I must be free to pursue what I think to be best. I'm free, I'm independent. He goes on to say, my life is my own. He thinks his brain is his own, and he's got the right to use it as he chooses. He thinks his time is his own, and he's got a right to think of the 24 hours in each day as belonging to him. If he gives a little bit of that time to God, he thinks he's done God a favour. He thinks his body is his own, and he's got a right to use it as he chooses. He thinks his money is his own. He starts with that premise that he belongs to himself. If he thinks about God at all, well, he thinks of God as being there for his benefit. He thinks that God owes him happiness and health and prosperity and protection. He thinks that if he gives anything to God, he's done God a favour. Whereas it's God's duty to give things to him. And if God doesn't do so, he's got a right to complain. These are the assumptions which lie behind all his thinking. These are the assumptions that lie behind all the intellectual enterprise in the world. These are the assumptions that lie behind those scientific-looking books of sociology and of psychiatry. These are the assumptions with which the universities conduct their seminars, that human beings are the centre of everything. And that is why the world's thinking is futile. If a person wants to think rightly, he must begin with God. All right thinking begins with God, with the fact that there is a God who is supreme, a God who is sovereign, a God who exists from all eternity, and to whom all the universe belongs, a God whose glory is the great goal of everything, a God who owns us and has got total rights over us, the God who made us for his own pleasure, who called us into being when we didn't choose it, and a God who will cut our lives short at the moment of his choosing. That's where all thinking has to begin. And the people of the world never think in that way. That's Paul's first accusation against them, that their thinking is futile. But then he adds something further about them. He says that their understanding is dark. They are darkened in their understanding. Well, that may just be another way of saying the same thing, but I don't think so. It's going further than that. He's now saying that they are blind. They are blind in their view of spiritual things. If they try to understand the things of God, if they try to grasp spiritual truths, they are incapable of doing so. They can't glimpse them because their understanding is dark. So their reasoning is twisted and bent when they think about anything, but especially when they try to understand the things of God, when they try to understand the soul of man, when they try to understand righteousness and holiness, when they try to understand the mystery of God's being, they are in utter darkness. So when you think about the religions of the world, and when you think about all their attempts to grapple with spiritual things, to understand why we are here in the world, what we're here for, where we've come from, where we're going to, you have to say that at the root of all these religions is darkness, simply blind people groping in the darkness, saying, I'm hoping to see something. We're completely incapable of seeing anything. And then the third accusation that Paul makes against them is this, that they are, that their hearts are hard. Their thinking is futile, their understanding is darkened. And then he says, as they are separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. This lack of reasoning power and this lack of spiritual sight is something for which they're to blame, because it arises out of hard hearts. In the end, the root of their problem is that they've got hearts that are set against God. It's not just that they are ignorant because of the hardness of their hearts. The reason they can't understand God is in the end because they don't want to. They don't want to believe that there is a supreme God to whom they owe everything. And then the fourth accusation Paul makes against them is that their conscience is seared. Having lost all sensitivity, they've given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. When you think about the things that people do, and Paul is especially thinking here about sexual sins, some of the things that they do are so sickening, so horrible, that you cannot imagine anybody choosing to do those things. And you are left asking, well, how could anybody reach such a depth of depravity that they could want to do anything so sick, so twisted, so perverted? And you say, even animals don't do the things that these people do. You ask, how can people reach such a stage? And Paul says their conscience is seared. They've lost all sensitivity. They're out of touch with any reality. There's nothing that disgusts them any longer. Rather, they give themselves over. They have given themselves over. They've abandoned all standards. They've deliberately thrown themselves into corruption, so that now they indulge in every kind of impurity, and they're always looking for new ways of perverting themselves. They're always looking for yet grosser things to do. There's a continual lust for more. Their thinking is futile. Their understanding is dark. Their conscience is seared. And their hearts are hard against God. And to summarize, they are separated from the life of God. They can have no contact with God. They can have no contact with God and his purity, his living being. Now, isn't Paul's picture of the world, of Gentile society, a bleak one? Yet that's the world that these Ephesians used to be part of before they were converted. It's the world we used to be part of before we were converted. This was us. Now, what is Paul's point? It's simply this. How could you want to be like those people? How could any Christian, having been saved out of that, how could he ever choose to be like that again? Surely once you've seen the world for what it is, once you've seen its futile thinking, once you've seen the darkened understanding, once you've realized that these people are living with a constant hardness of heart against God, once you've seen that their conscience is seared and that they're running into everything that's depraved and shameful, surely you're going to say, please, please, don't let me be like that. And you're going to distance yourself from it as far as you possibly can. Christians must aim to be different from the world. They must aim to leave behind the thinking of the world and the attitudes of the world and the values of the world and the lifestyle of the world. And they want to be as different from the world as they possibly can be. Now, why do I emphasize that? And why does Paul emphasize it? Look what he says in verse 17. I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord. Clearly Paul feels he has to emphasize that. And go on to chapter 5, verse 6. He comes back to it. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them. Right at the beginning of this passage, he says it, and then right at the end of the passage he comes back to it. You've got to be different from the world. Why is he so emphatic? Well, surely the hint is there in chapter 5, verse 6. Let no one deceive you with empty words. There were people in Paul's day who were saying Christians don't need to be different from the world. There were people then who were saying Christians must try as far as possible to find common ground with the world. They must try to adapt themselves to the world. They must try to fit in with the world. They were saying it then, and they're saying it now. Well, if you want to reach the world, you must try and be approachable. And that means that you must try and dress like the people of the world. And you must use the same sort of language that they use. And you must use the same sort of jargon that they use. And you must use the same communication methods that the people of the world use. You must you must listen to the same music that they listen to. And you must read the same books that they read. And you must go to the same films. And you must be there in the same bars as they're in. Because that's the only way you can reach them, by becoming as like them as possible. You can't reach the world, we're told, unless you build bridges in that way. And bridge building means aiming to be as much like them as possible. Well, I cannot find one place in the whole of the New Testament where Christians are told you must aim to be like the people of the world. What we are told in passage after passage after passage is that we must aim to be different from the world. If the world's thinking is so twisted, if the world's understanding is so darkened, if the world is set in such relentless hatred against God, if the world's conscience is so seared, and if the world's lifestyle is shaped by all of that, then there is only one option for us. And that is to say, I intend to be different from the world around me. And I want the church to be visibly different from the world around me. When people come into one of our meetings, we want them to see immediately that our values aren't the values of the world. That our approach to things isn't the approach of the world. We're living in a society where everybody wants to be zany and cool and laid back and chatty and user-friendly. That's the world's outlook in our generation. It's part of the world's self-pleasing. So the moment somebody comes into one of our meetings, we want them to know that we're rebuking that. Even by the way we dress and the way we talk and the way we conduct ourselves. We're saying we don't share that the world's view on that. We don't believe that life exists just to be fun. If that's the idol that the world has raised up in our generation, that everything's got to be fun, then we're going to rebuke it by the very way we conduct ourselves in God's presence. Your living must be different from the world. Your thinking must be different from the world. Your values must be different from the world. The second key perspective that Paul brings here: Christians must aim to live out what they have heard and seen in Jesus Christ. Christians must aim to live out what they've heard and seen in Jesus Christ. What is the great corrective to being like the world? You, however, did not come to know Christ that way. Surely you heard of him and were taught in him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. Now, when Paul uses the word Jesus, as he does there, he's thinking about Jesus in his earthly life. Jesus is that name he was given as a human being, as a child, by his mother. Paul is saying, you've heard about Jesus. You've heard about how Jesus lived, about what he did, about what he taught. That was when you were converted. You were converted by hearing about Jesus Christ. You heard of him and were taught in him in accordance with the truth that's in Jesus. All society, all the world around you is gripped by lies, by deceit, by twisted thinking. But you caught a glimpse of the truth when you looked at Jesus Christ. You saw in his life, you heard in his words, truth, reality, straightness, purity. In him you saw what a normal human being should be. You saw perfect uprightness. In his relationships, you saw what normal relationships should be. You saw the way he related to his mother. You saw the way he related to his family. You saw the way he related to his friends and his disciples and the ungodly. In Jesus Christ, you saw what relationships should be. In Jesus Christ, you heard what speech should be. You heard how a perfectly wise man, a perfectly good man, a perfectly truthful man speaks. In Jesus Christ, you saw what emotions should be. You saw what holy anger means. And you saw what compassion means. You have seen truth in Jesus Christ. You have seen the perfection of humanity. You have seen God's likeness revealed in a human life. And so now that becomes your great guideline. You don't model yourself on the world. Rather, you are modeling yourself all the time upon Jesus Christ. You want to know what humility means? Then look at him when he's kneeling down in front of his disciples, washing their feet. You want to know what it means to keep the fifth commandment, then you look at him there on the cross and you see his lovely concern for his mother. You want to know how a man prays, a godly man. Well, then you go to the Garden of Gethsemane and you watch him in prayer and you listen to the words from his lips. You want to know what obedience to the Father's will mean. Then you watch that whole life. You want to know how a godly man uses the scriptures. Well, then you go with him to the wilderness and you hear his, "It is written, it is written, it is written." You want to know how we ought to relate to the needy in our society. Well, then you watch him with a leper stretching out his hand to touch him. And you watch the patience with which he signs to the deaf and dumb man. Jesus himself is to be the template for Christian living. Paul is telling them on the one side, you turn away from the world and its values. But then he says, and you turn towards Christ. You turn towards the truth as it is in Jesus. A Christian spends his whole life studying Jesus Christ, meditating on Jesus Christ, filling his heart and his mind with the Lord Jesus as he's recorded for us in this book. And then the third perspective that Paul brings. Christians aim to put off the old self and to put on the new self. Verse 22, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. A Christian must never forget that he's a changed man, a changed woman. A Christian looks back on the way he lived before he was converted, the way he thought, the way he reasoned, the way he used his money, the values by which he lived, the way he related to other people. A Christian looks back on all that and he says, that was my old self. That was what I was. but that is not what I am now. That's gone. That's finished with. He views that as being decisively in the past. And every time he finds those old patterns of behavior rising up again, he says, that's not me. That's not the person I am now. That's my old self. It's my former way of life. That old self, that old life, was one rotten with deceitful desires. But now I am a new creature. On that day when I came to Christ, on that day when I was baptized, I rose again out of the water. In Christ Jesus, I rose again to begin a new life, and I am going to live as a new person. I put on the new self. I am determined to be the new me. Different people have tried to use to find different pictures to illustrate what Paul means. I suppose one of the more helpful ones is to think of a girl who's got married, and on her wedding day she stood up and she's made vows in which she's promised to love, honor and obey this particular man, and she's taken a ring on her finger and her name has been changed on that day, and that day has changed everything for her. From now on, she's got to live with a new set of priorities. From now on, she's got to live with a new set of values. It's going to affect the way she spends her time. It's going to affect the way that she relates to her friends. If she tries to live now in just the same way as she did before she was married, she's going to create a disaster. She's got to be remembering all the time that she is a new woman, that she has got a new name, that she is in a new situation, that she has got new responsibilities. A friend rings her up and says, oh, do you think we could go out together on Friday evening? Now, before she was married, she didn't have to worry about that. She could simply say, yeah, because she was her own woman. She was free. She could go out whenever she chose. But now, when she hears her friend saying that, she has to pull herself up and she has to say, well, hang on, I'm not just free to say yes in that situation, because now I'm answerable to my husband. Now I've got loyalties to him that I didn't have before. I can't just waltz out whenever I choose. She has to remind herself that the old has gone and that she's now a new person. Well, so it is then with every believer. We have to be reminding ourselves constantly that we have made a decisive break with the past, and that we have become new people. We have put on the new self, which is created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. The new person that we've become is a God-like person, a person who's being restored to the image of God. A person who must actually be like God in his righteousness and holiness. We've put off that old person with his or her selfish, self-centered, worldly values and priorities. And instead, we've put on a new self, a self in which we are consciously seeking to do what God does, and to speak as God speaks, and to think as God thinks. In every individual situation that comes up, we say, I put away what was past, and now I choose to be God-like. And it's in Jesus Christ that I learn what it means to be God-like. So Paul is telling us here that there is something negative which must be done and something positive which must be done. I'm constantly... we are putting off the former way of life. Constantly we are putting on the new way of life. Now, those are the three great perspectives. And then, as I say, Paul goes on in verses 25 onwards to work those things out in the practical relationships of life, in the practical situations that we face. I'm just going to move through this very quickly indeed. What I want you to see as we just read onwards is how these three great perspectives underlie all the advice, all the counsel, all the commands that Paul gives. He deals with two broad areas. He deals firstly with the matter of relationships in the church, and then he deals with the matter of sexuality. And in each case, you'll see how he deals with negative things and positive things. How with each subject that he touches on, he talks firstly about what must be put away, and then he talks about what must be developed. What must be ended, and what must be encouraged. First of all, in the matter of relationships in the church, you can see that. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood. That's the negative side. That's the putting off. You put off falsehood. But that's not enough, is it? It's not enough just to stop telling lies and you speak truth to your neighbour, for we're all members of one body. As I say, this is relationships within the church, within the body of the church. Negatively, you stop telling lies. You make sure you never deceive your fellow church members. But then positively you say, I am going to speak truth to them. I'm going to make sure that every word I say helps them to see things clearly and truly again. You put away sinful anger. In your anger, do not sin. And in its place, you put timely reconciliation. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry, and don't give the devil a foothold. It's not enough to keep yourself from sinful anger. There has to be that policy of seeking reconciliation. Paul's advice is so practical, isn't it? If you've fallen out with your Christian brother, it's night time, before you go to bed, seek reconciliation. Don't let that situation be carried forward till the morning. And then he says, verse 28, he who has been stealing must steal no longer. That's the negative side. There were people in that church in Ephesus who were exploiting one another. They weren't pulling their weight. They were borrowing money and not returning it. They may have been stealing in all sorts of different ways. Well, they must realize that that's totally unacceptable. But, says Paul, it's not enough to stop stealing. They must now work, doing something useful with their own hands. They must give to those in need. Stealing must be put away, but hard work and generosity must take its place. Unwholesome talk, verse 29. Don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what's helpful in building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. All right, you must stop talking in an unwholesome way. You must stop gossiping. You must stop saying spiteful things, unhelpful things, trivial things. But in its place, there must be something positive. You only speak what is helpful for building others up according to their needs. So the Christian standard isn't, I must never say anything harmful. The Christian standard is, I will only say what is helpful. I will not let one sentence go out of my mouth that is not actually helpful and edifying. It's not enough to put away the negative. Paul demands that there must be the positive. It doesn't mean we're always going to be talking about spiritual things. What he's saying is that with every sentence we say, we are going to be concerned that it will be a sentence that will do good to others. And then he deals with the matter of hostility, all the different ways in which nastiness can manifest itself between people. Get rid of all bitterness, rage and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Yes, those things have got to go. But be kind and compassionate to one another. What comes in their place? Practical kindness. Compassion for one another's needs. Forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Be imitators of God. Live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. It's not enough for me to say, well, I've not harmed anybody today. I've not been nasty to anybody today. I've not shouted and raged at anybody today. That's not enough. Paul says, I have to be kind to every believer. I have to be compassionate to every believer. I have to sacrifice myself for every one of my brothers and sisters as Christ offered himself as a sacrifice. Do you see the thread that runs through all these verses? It's the fact that there must be the putting away and there must be the taking on. Too often holiness has been understood in purely negative terms. A holy man is a man who doesn't tell lies. A holy man is a man who doesn't get angry for no reason. A holy man is a man who doesn't steal. A holy man is a man who doesn't talk in an unwholesome way. Paul would say that's only half. That's only the preparation, as it were. Yes, those things must be put away. But a holy man is a man who actually speaks truth. A holy man is a man who seeks reconciliation. A holy man is a man who works with his own hands and gives generously to others. A holy man is a man whose every word is for the good of others. A holy man is a man whose life is full of kindness and compassion, and who is constantly sacrificing himself for the good of others. A holy man imitates God in all these things. These are matters of relationships within the church. And then finally, Paul applies this then to matters of sexuality in verses 3 onwards in chapter 5. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality. He's saying that immoral ideas are not acceptable subjects of conversation among Christians. Yes, the Bible can be very frank in dealing with sexual matters, but anything that that puts into people's minds defiling thoughts is utterly unacceptable. There must be no kind of impurity or greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. There is one standard, and it's the standard that is laid down in the very beginning in the book of Genesis. The standard of one man and one woman, loving one another in a lifelong, loyal love, using their minds and their bodies and their emotional capacities exclusively for one another's delight in the fear of God. And anything that deviates from that pattern, anything that belittles that pattern, is utterly out of place among God's people. There must be no obscenity. There must be no foolish talk. There must be no coarse joking, which are out of place. But rather, thanksgiving. Again, do you see the negative and the positive? Here are the people of the world, and they're greedy. And they're not content with that delightful one-to-one relationship of marriage. They're not content to find their pleasure, their joy, their satisfaction there. Instead, they're always looking in a greedy way for pleasures outside of that. But a believer puts away such greed and he embraces thanksgiving. He is so grateful to God for giving him this true pattern. And he lives within it and he's content within it. He's not looking all the time for new satisfactions, because he's content with God's gracious gift of marriage. Greed gives way to contentment. Of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a man is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. In the end, you see, Paul is very plain, as all the Bible writers are, that he is not laying down some optional standard. He is simply saying, unless there is this sort of holiness, unless there is this absolute determination to honour God in every part of life, in relationships, in our control of our own bodies, in the way we build our homes and our marriages, in our lives within the church, unless there is that total determination to pursue holiness, then there can be no salvation. No immoral, impure, greedy person has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, don't be partners with them. We said at the beginning that we were talking about the standards by which Christians are to live. And Paul's final words is that those standards are absolute, and those standards are non-negotiable. This passage calls us back again to the holiness without which no man shall see God. We'll sing together.